You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. In our third hour today, I want to lay out for you two things. One, a strategy to knock down the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling that's actually found and grounded in the Constitution. And two, what we should do, how we should respond as a progressive community if the Supreme Court knocks down Obamacare on Thursday. I actually have a strategy, and I think it's a pretty cool one. So we will be discussing that in our third hour. In our second hour, Phil Kirpin's going to drop by. Phil is now the president of American Commitment, author of Democracy Denied, and he says we should keep the minimum wage right where it is. And I'm saying, you want the economy to work? Jack that thing up. We're going to have a debate about it. But in this hour, I want to talk about why do we have an economy? Right, the most important question that's not being asked in this election cycle. There's a lot of questions being thrown around in this presidential campaign between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. Questions like, you know, did Romney really create jobs at Bain Capital, or how many did he destroy? Or how much should the super rich pay in taxes? Or where was President Obama really born? Some of these questions are important, and some are completely absurd. And there's a bunch of really fundamental questions that haven't even been asked and that desperately need to be asked if we're ever going to get our economic bearings back. And in fact, the core question, the most important of all these questions, is a question that the late billionaire Sir James Goldsmith asked of Charlie Rose on Charlie Rose's show back in 1994. Here's Goldsmith asking the question.
Can you explain, what is the purpose of an economy in your view?
Okay. So, once again, let's play that a little louder, Shano.
Can you explain, what is the purpose of an economy in your view?
What is the purpose of an economy in your view? And here is Goldsmith answering his own rhetorical question. This is, now, keep in mind, at the time, this man was the richest man on earth. Here you go.
The economy is there to serve the fundamental needs of society.
Yes.
Which are prosperity.
Yes.
Which are stability.
Yes.
And which are contentment.
So, prosperity, stability, and contentment. That's the purpose of an economy. That's why we organize economies. That's why we have governments organized among citizens who create laws that make it possible for companies to have all kinds of cool benefits. You know, they can deduct equipment, they can deduct interest, they can go out, people who are working for these companies can go out to lunch and write it off. You and I pay for it. Why do we do that? Why are we supporting them? Well, very simply, because those companies engaging in commerce will be of benefit to society. As Goldsmith said, prosperity, stability, and contentment. Back in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, did you know that they used to call this the Republican Depression? During Roosevelt's years, it was mostly, he didn't do it so much because he tried not to be all that partisan on this issue, but it was broadly referred to in newspapers and others, not as the Great Depression. That didn't come along until the 40s when the history of the Depression started being written. It was referred to as the Republican Depression. Anyhow, back in the 30s, during the Republican Depression, when prosperity, stability, and contentment were pretty hard to come by, President Franklin Roosevelt thought that he could restore the true purpose of an economy by establishing a good quality of life for as many people as possible. Back in 1936, Roosevelt said, "Necessitous men are not free men. Liberty requires the opportunity to make a living decent according to the standard of the time, a living which gives man not only enough to live by, but something to live for." Roosevelt knew that if someone was hungry and didn't have food, or sick and didn't have medical care, or broke and didn't have a job, then they're not free. But when our economy provides these basic essentials for freedom, then Americans could finally find stability and contentment, giving them a chance to also take entrepreneurial risks and eventually find prosperity as well. Remember Goldsmith's definition of an economy. It's there to provide prosperity, stability, and contentment to the society. So to do just that, in 1944, FDR introduced a second Bill of Rights. Here's his introduction to it.
In our day, certain economic proofs have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed.
Right, and so this Bill of Rights is going to establish basically an economic Bill of Rights, an economy that provides for freedom. FDR goes on to lay out a new set of rights that all Americans should be granted. They include the right to a job, which means if a job is a right, if unemployment goes above a certain point, the government steps in as the employer of last resort, as happened in the 1930s. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food, clothing, and recreation to your family. The right of every business person to trade in freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies. Boy, we sure have gone far from that. The right to a decent home. He wanted to actually make, now keep in mind, if these things become rights, then we the people can say, okay, you know, we are going to make this happen for us. A right to adequate medical care. We still don't have that. A right to adequate protection from the old age, sickness, accidents, and unemployment. And a right to a good education, excuse me. Roosevelt never succeeded in getting his second Bill of Rights passed. In fact, he died of a stroke, you know, kind of mid through his campaign. But at least his definition of an economy being something that serves the need of the society and provides the best quality of life for the greatest number of people, it was accepted for the next several decades by both Republicans and Democrats who supported labor unions, high taxation on the rich, and a regulated economy that protects American jobs and American industry. Between 1930 and 1980, Americans knew the answer to that fundamental question. Why do we have an economy? What's its purpose? Even Republicans knew it. As Republican Dwight Eisenhower wrote to his brother, "It is quite clear that the federal government cannot avoid or escape responsibilities which the mass of the people firmly believes should be undertaken by it. Should any political party," Republican President Dwight Eisenhower wrote, "should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history." There's a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are a few Texas oil millionaires. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid. But then with end of quote. But then with Ronald Reagan came a new answer, one that we're still stuck with today. Rather than an economy serving the needs of society, Reagan and this new breed of supply-side economists and free marketers believed that society exists to serve the needs of an economy. In other words, you and me are here to serve the fat cats. Or more specifically, the society serves the needs of the leaders within an economy, corporations and their CEOs, or as Fox News calls them, job creators, which brought us the greed is good mentality in the 1980s when CEOs were encouraged to cut salaries of their workers, bust up unions, pollute the skies, gamble on Wall Street, all to maximize wealth. Then came laws to cement this new definition of an economy, massive tax cuts for so-called job creators, deregulation of Wall Street banksters, and so-called free trade so national corporations could abandon America and morph into transnational behemoths. You get what's happened here? This fundamental redefinition of what freedom means? I want to continue on this just a little bit on the other side of this break, and then we'll open up a conversation about this topic.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How has the new Reagan business model of America devastated freedom in our country? Okay, so along with Ronald Reagan came this new idea. right? I was just laying out this new business model, an entirely new definition of an economy, what it is, why it is, how it works. And it came out of that era, and it's still with us. I mean, we're pretty much stuck with this. And this is one in which making money and profit is the goal of an economy, pure and simple. To hell with contentment, stability, prosperity, that stuff doesn't matter. What matters is that people like Mitt Romney can get rich. The freedom to pollute. I mean, this is FDR seriously believed. To FDR, freedom meant freedom from want and destitution. It meant the freedom to step out and do things because you had your basic needs met. That was Franklin Roosevelt. That's what Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, Abraham Lincoln talked like this. This is the historic view of what freedom means in America. But Reagan said, no. Freedom means that you're free to pollute. You're free to outsource. You're free to take risks on Wall Street. Or at least your banksters are free to. You're free to illegally foreclose on millions of Americans. You're free to buy an election. Basically, the freedom to be a pirate equity manager and raid American companies, laying off thousands of workers to maximize profits. Mitt Romney is the walking embodiment of this new definition of freedom, as well as the lead spokesman for the new answer to the question, what is the purpose of an economy? He's running for president on it. He and his donors, like Sheldon Adelson, Karl Rove, and the Koch brothers, they all believe that we have an economy so that he and his buddies can get filthy rich. That's why corporations' share of tax revenue has plummeted since Reagan, while working people's share of tax revenue has increased. That's why the top 1% have seen their income skyrocket 275% since Reagan, yet the rest of us have barely seen our incomes grow. It's why unionization rates have fallen since Reagan, and along with those rates, the middle class's share of income has also dropped. With 49 million Americans in poverty, 45 million Americans on food stamps, 53 million Americans without health insurance, prosperity, stability, and contentment for the vast majority of us, good luck. This is all happening because we failed. We the American people, we failed to take a step back, look around, and ask ourselves just this simple, fundamental question. What's an economy for anyway? Why do we create economies? If progressives are going to take back America, just like they did with Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt in the early 1900s, FDR, the Democratic Roosevelt in the 1930s, then it's imperative we redefine both freedom and the purpose of an economy. And that begins with asking that question, what is freedom? What is the purpose of an economy? Everything else, from universal health care to the rights of working people to regulations on oil barons and banksters, everything else follows from those questions. It's time to get back to earlier definitions of freedom, not as the Koch brothers have redefined it, as their right to pollute and corrupt politicians freely, but as FDR defined it, as the right for Americans to be free to chase their dreams because their basic needs, like health care, education, and a job, are secure. It's time to promote stability and prosperity again by saying the economy is here to serve the needs of society and not to serve the needs of Mitt Romney and his buddies. Let's start asking the right questions. Here's Franklin Roosevelt laying out his vision, you know, his what should be in the second Bill of Rights. Listen.
Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom. Freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, the right to a good education.
It's just very straightforward stuff, right? Franklin Roosevelt is saying these things should be rights. And you know what's amazing? In most of the well-developed countries of the world, they are rights. Everybody can get a decent education in Germany and Sweden and Norway and Finland and Denmark and France. No problem. People can take vacations. People have a voice in the workplace. They have the right to, if their job market collapses, if there's another Republican Great Depression, at least until this austerity woo-woo stuff started, like, you know, a couple of years ago with the election of David Cameron in the UK, and then this sweeping across the parts of Europe anyway, the bankster-driven austerity. It used to be that, you know, government would step in and say, okay, you know, unemployment's above a certain point. We're going to start hiring people. There's always stuff that needs to be done. The right to a job. So that government can say to an employer, you know, you're going to have to conduct yourself in a way that actually keeps jobs in the United States. If you send jobs offshore, overseas, if you do what Romney did with Bain Capital, and what Romney did with the state of Massachusetts, for that matter, when he laid off state workers and hired people in India to answer phones on behalf of the state. If you do that, you're violating people's rights in this country. That's against the law. You can't do that. Roosevelt had a clear vision, and we need to recapture that vision. And the question for the day, or at least for the hour, is how can we get this into the dialogue? How can we get Democrats and Republicans to pick this up?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And how do you define freedom? Now, we know, you know, the Koch brothers define freedom as the freedom to buy politicians. How do you define freedom? Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, 35 minutes past the hour. This is really a key issue. Let me just lay this out. This is an absolute key issue. What does freedom mean? The Republicans have been pounding this idea for three decades now. In fact, a lot of you literally grew up with this. The idea that freedom means that capitalists can do whatever they damn well please without interference from the rest of us when we organize ourselves together into this thing called government. Now, that is not historically how Americans viewed freedom. What does freedom mean to you? How do we change it, that definition of freedom, from you are free to die in the gutter like a rat? Remember the debate where Ron Paul was asked this question? How do we change it from that to you are free to go off and be an entrepreneur or start your own business or do, you know, pursue your dreams because you know that, God forbid, should something happen to you, you know, health-wise, that you're covered, that you can go to any doctor anywhere, any hospital anywhere, get any treatment anywhere, no problem. You're in good shape. That's freedom. Freedom doesn't mean you have the freedom to just like die in this. Anyhow, enough of the rant. John in Minneapolis, the lines are slammed here. John in Minneapolis. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to make the comment that, you know, schools of economics have basically have this orthodox idea that from Milton Friedman, and it's unquestioned, and it's taken over not just schools of economics, but schools of business. It's also really demoted the importance of the humanities and any other school within the university system. And they take, you know, I'm a respiratory therapist. I get a wage. They take a certain amount of my money and they give it to the University of Minnesota. And they also take a certain amount of my money and give it nationwide to support education, which I don't have any problem with.
Who is this they you're talking about?
Undermining, you know, the middle class, and they're undermining.
Who is the they that is taking your money?
Who is taking my money? The state. The state is taking my money.
You mean
they are investing
you're paying taxes?
In universities that are perpetuating.
Okay, you have the wrong villain here, John. The Koch brothers have donated money to over 100 universities around the country, and they donate it with strings attached that you have to give away copies of Atlas Shrugged. You have to teach it as part of the curriculum. You have to any professor gets hired in the university, the Koch brothers get to review. Just Google this. It'll blow your mind. Koch brothers and universities. They have basically, and it's not just them, but I mean, there's other right-wing billionaires who are doing the same thing. And what they're doing is remodeling our education system. You're right. Our college departments of economics in particular have been horribly corrupted by these kinds of things. Paul in Denver. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Oh, I want to ask you a question, Tom.
Yeah.
Why don't they lean more on the mess that Bush made? My God, he started two illegal wars. He turned the banks loose. He turned the mortgage companies loose. And we're all paying for it right now. All people lost their houses and they lost their jobs.
Yeah.
And I can't believe what these Republicans are doing to us.
Yeah, well,
they want to
make
us slave.
I think a lot of people get that. And I personally don't get why Obama doesn't campaign more on I've been cleaning up. You know, I've been the guy in the circus with the shovel behind the elephant here, you know, for the last 3 years. I mean, it's an iconic image. It's this should be it, right? But he's chosen not to. Frankly, Bush for years campaigned against Clinton. I mean, you know, and Reagan spent most of his presidency campaigning against Jimmy Carter, or blaming everything on Jimmy Carter. But you know, people don't remember that, so. Paul in Amory, Mass. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, man. I was listening to your program here, and you're talking about how do we get back to what freedom used to mean.
Yeah.
I think it's very simple. As Americans, we need to take the time to write. I've been doing this for the last 6 months, just going crazy with it, writing congressmen, the president, local people, whoever, and telling them, look back at history, especially during FDR's terms, and see what worked then and what didn't work, and to read some of what he said.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think if they would, Democrat, Republican, Independents, all of them together, then sit down and quit acting like three-year-olds at day camp, arguing, and figure out what's good for all of us. And the second point is, back when taxes used to be high, that gave a businessman an incentive, instead of taking all of his money and putting it in a bank account, to reinvest in another business. That way he could be more wealthier, but it wouldn't be liquid. You know what I'm saying? He couldn't
just
sit down and put his hands on it. He would have
right.
to sell out and get it. And they, you know, that's what he did when he got ready to retire, turn it over to his kids. I mean, he was still just as wealthy, he just
right.
didn't have it.
And this is why small businesses and medium-sized businesses stayed in families for generation after generation after generation, why they were stable. It's why people could get a job and work in that same job for 30 or 40 years until they retired. It's this, it's one simple thing, and that is high top marginal tax rates on income over $1 million a year. That was the thing that kept businesses stable and strong and in America and kept money in those businesses. You are absolutely right. And when Ronald Reagan did away with that in from 83 to 86, you know, systematically taking the top tax rate down from 74% to 28%, he destroyed the future of the American dream. He began the destruction of the American middle class and began the creation of a new plutocratic wealth class, an aristocratic oligarchy that right now is sitting around. Last weekend they were meeting in Utah with Mitt Romney, and they were meeting in San Diego with the Koch brothers, planning how they're going to buy the next elections. And you can thank Ronald Reagan for that. It is so wrong. Paul, thank you for the call. Brenda in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Brenda, what's up?
Hey, I called yesterday, but I got arthritis in my hand, so I couldn't hold the phone any longer. But I appreciate you calling twos and fours to you and yours.
Thank you.
And I would like to know, are we in a coup?
It depends on your definition of coup, but it seems to me like the rich guys have taken over.
Well, I think we're in a coup to take over the United States without the guns. And the thing of it is, I believe in everything you said. I'm 66 years old, so I've been through the Reagan and hierarchy and all that kind of stuff. I haven't voted since right now. I voted for Obama, and I hope the man has the strength to stand up and know that he's our only hope.
Because well, it's not. He's
here. We're doomed.
Brenda, I am very thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. I am very concerned that if Romney gets in, we're going to lose the Supreme Court and we'll be doomed. And we may get in stupid wars and we're going to see more, you know, deficit spending because that's what Republicans always do. All those kinds of things. But the big concern, I would not say Obama is our savior. Nobody is. We are our savior. That's the whole idea of America. This is what, you know, this is what George Washington had. Was he had an energized populace that was willing to go to war against the British. This is what Abraham Lincoln had. He had an energized populace that was willing to go to war to keep the republic together. This is what Teddy Roosevelt had. He had an energized populace, a progressive revolution that was willing to support him in calling out the big corporations. In 1907, passing the Tillman Act that made it a federal felony to give, for a corporation to give money to a politician. That in breaking up Standard Oil into 27 or 28 companies and in you know being the trust buster, he had the wind behind his back of the people. It's what Franklin Roosevelt had. He had the Bonus Army. He had the Occupy movement that was occupying from the White House all the way down to the Potomac River. And it's what Lyndon Johnson had. He had the Civil Rights movement, and he had well, and ultimately the anti-war movement that Richard Nixon exploited. You know, saying, yes, I'll end the war, just elect me, ha, ha, ha. It was ultimately Gerry Ford who did it. But nonetheless, there were people in the streets that made it possible for these presidents to do these things. So if you want Obama to bring about a second Bill of Rights, like Franklin Roosevelt laid out, then we have to be there behind him. We have to be the ones, you know, making all this happen. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's up? Got a minute to the break.
Real quick, we got all the Republicans whining and complaining about how much it costs, how much everybody gets paid at the colleges. Well, our wonderful Governor Mitch Daniels is announcing that he's going to be the new president of Purdue University when he gets out of office this year.
Wow. So it's kind of ironic that the Republicans like Mitch Daniels are complaining about how much the presidents of the universities make, and then he goes off to be one. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, well, it doesn't surprise me. Mitch Daniels, you know, I mean, these guys, this is their. Thank you, Mike, for the call. This is the Republican idea of public service, is you use, you know, whether you're in a regulatory position or whether you're in Congress or whether you're a governor, whatever it is, use it as a stepping stone to private wealth. This isn't how it used to be. Jimmy Carter didn't get rich after leaving the White House. Harry Truman didn't get rich after leaving the White House. He drove home to Missouri. Lived in a modest home. Lived on a pension. You know, Reagan, Bush, these guys, it's like, how to get rich after you leave the White House? Well, Clinton too. It shouldn't be. We'll be back 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what does freedom mean to you? To me, it means the freedom to step off and take risks.
That's the way you do money for nothing.
Welcome back to Talk Media for the sane among us, Tom Hartman Program. Dan in Los Angeles. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today? Dan?
Yeah, hey, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
Get this country back on track and get our jobs back. Why don't we push for laws to make all imports have to be made under the same environmental and labor laws that we have to abide by?
Yeah, that's a good start. That's a good start. And, you know, and in fact, I would even take it beyond that. I would say, let's just blow up these trade deals or, you know, yeah, you can enforce environmental standards and things like that. But I would like to see a return to tariffs. You know, where we simply say, if you want to bring something into this country, if the way it used to be, I used to use shoes as the example all the time. It's really easily understood that if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a $15 pair of shoes made in the United States, and you want to make those shoes in Mexico, where it's 50 cents worth of labor, you want to make them in Vietnam, where it's 20 cents worth of labor, when they hit the shore of the United States, if they come from Mexico, there's a 50 cent tariff. If they come from Vietnam, there's an 80 cent tariff. So no matter what, you're going to pay the dollar. You might as well pay it to laborers here in the United States as someplace else, because that labor cost is going to be absorbed. And if there's environmental costs, the same thing. If you can pour out pollution in Mexico or in Vietnam and that you couldn't do legally here, then you assign a dollar value to that and simply apply it as a tariff. And that way you don't even need the regulations and rules. You don't need to have somebody going around inspecting sites and making sure factories are right and all that kind of thing. It becomes very simple. I mean, this is the way that the George Washington administration laid it out, and these kind of trade rules were in place up until the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan started deconstructing them, and then it went on steroids in the 1980s with the NAFTA and CAFTA, or in the 1990s, NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, all the free trade agreements. But, Dan, excellent point. Thank you for calling, and thank you for making it. James in Chicago. Hey, James, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? I am a conservative, and I just like to give, you know, my point of view, and I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
To what I have to say. First of all, you're talking about supply-side economics, and obviously, you know, one of the major tenets of that is that, you know, a reduction in the top rates of wealthy Americans will result in an increase in tax revenues.
Which has never been demonstrated to work.
Well, I would like to give an example of where I have seen that work. I was reading, and it was saying that in 1979, the top 0.01% paid about 2.7% of the overall amount of taxes. So that's just the 0.01%. And today, I believe the tax rate is about 10 points lower, give or take, might be more, might be less. But it's definitely lower, and today they're paying about 6.5% of the overall taxes, which, in my opinion, proves that even though that the tax rate has gone down for them, they're still contributing significantly more money.
James, they've suckered you. They didn't give you the statistics about the growth of wealth or income for that top one-tenth of 1%, did they?
No.
No, they didn't. The top 1% of Americans since Reagan's presidency to today have seen a 275% increase in their income, that is, in the dollars that they're getting. And we have now, and the average working person has seen about a 2% decrease during those 30 years. It would have been about a 1% increase if it wasn't for the Bush Great Recession. So basically, the rest of us got stuck with nothing, you know, got nothing. The rich got vastly richer. Now, of course, if you get vastly richer, even if you're paying a lower tax rate, there's going to be more tax revenue. The other thing is that if you look back in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, you know, before Reagan, again, before supply-side economics, the average person, the average CEO was making between 30 and 32 times what their janitors were making. Okay, so the average CEO, I mean, it was very rare that any CEO made over $1 million in today's dollars, inflation adjusted for today. Because if they did, they started paying 74% income tax. So what they did was they kept the money in the company. And what this did was it caused incredible stability. You had people who literally started in the mailroom at General Motors and ended up as the CEO. They worked in the company for 40 years. And in addition to that, they kept the company's money in the company. Because why take it out? You get taxed on it. Whether it's General Motors or whether it's, you know, the local furniture store. When Reagan dropped that top tax rate, these very wealthy people started pulling money out like crazy, hot money, and were looking for places to gamble with it. And thus, you know, bubbles. We had the dot-com bubble, we had the bank bubble, we've had the real estate bubble. All of these bubbles are the result of hot money in our economy. But now we have a situation where one family, five heirs of Sam Walton, one family own more wealth than you know, the bottom third of America, where the top 400 wealthiest people, just 400 people, the Forbes 400, 400 people own more wealth than half of America, than 150 million other Americans. And half of those 400 people paid no income taxes last year. That's the other half of the equation that you're not seeing in those statistics. And that's a classic example of, you know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Supply side economics doesn't work. It's a really simple equation. Supply side, first of all, that's not even supply side economics. That's some crazy idea that Art Laffer had on with a curve on a napkin. That's Laffer curve economics that Reagan adopted. Supply side economics says, okay, the classic economic theory that was first really well articulated by Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations in 1776 and in his book Theory of Moral Sentiments, says that demand is what drives an economy. The more people you have to buy something, the more the economy is going to grow and the more entrepreneurs are going to step in to meet that demand. And everybody understood that right up until the 1980s when Reagan came along and said, demand, you know, and the idea was always, it's because demand drives an economy, we want to put more and more money into working people's pockets because working people spend 100% of the money they get. And that thus they create demand. Whereas if you give extra money to rich people, it doesn't create demand. They put it in a Swiss bank account. Romney's got a Swiss bank account. He's got a Cayman's bank account. He's got all these foreign. His kids have $100 million in a trust fund. It's doing nothing. It's going nowhere. It is not creating demand. And so Reagan, having to confront this problem that everybody understood that, you know, the economy was driven by working people having money in their pockets, said, no. It's rich people having money in their pockets, and it's supply that's driving things. He was wrong. History has proven him wrong. Thanks for the call, James. Good luck.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. There is a serious pushback going on across the United States to this insane Citizens United Supreme Court ruling that says that corporations are mystical people of some kind and that money isn't property, it's speech. There are a lot of people pushing back, among them the Supreme Court of the state of Montana, and now the citizens of the state of Montana, and even better, the governor of the state of Montana. Governor Brian Schweitzer is on the line with us. Governor, welcome back.
Well, good to be on. Listen, you know, you probably read in the paper here just a few months back that Walmart got themselves in big trouble down in Mexico. See, apparently they went down there and they were trying to build a Walmart, but the local people rose up against because there were some archaeological things in that area and they didn't want it built there. So they spread some $20 million out to a bunch of politicians and they got their way. Well, they got themselves in big trouble back home, not in Mexico because they had bribed people. They got themselves in trouble back here in the USA because in 1977, Congress passed the Corrupt Foreign Practices Act so that a private citizen or a American-based corporation can't bribe foreign officials. It's against the law. Well, with the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court says, you dang right. We have a monopoly on bribery in this country. If you're going to bribe a politician, you corporations, you got to bribe an American politician. It's against the law to bribe them anywhere else. That's what this Citizens United decision has meant. And by the way, corporations, American-based corporations, are owned by people from all over the world. So now we have foreign money that's entering our elections. Perfect. What could be better than having, for example, the Chinese and the Latin Americans and the Russians buy elections legally in the United States?
Yeah, and recently one of our politicians, I think it might have been Newt Gingrich, was talking. No, I'm not. I'd have to go back.
I'm going to finish it for you. John McCain. Said,
oh, it was John McCain. That, you're right.
That
absolutely.
That money is coming from Chinese casinos.
Yes.
So now we have Chinese cash, dirty, secret casino Chinese money buying presidential election. Perfect. What could go wrong?
Yeah, what could go wrong? So Initiative 166 is happening in Montana. Tell us about this.
Well, what we're saying is that Initiative 166 says that in Montana, all the way back to 1912, we've said corporations cannot buy elections. You're not allowed to use corporate money, and we've had low limits. Well, you've got Citizens United, these big shots in the Supreme Court. They say, Montana, you've been wrong. In fact, the Montana Supreme Court, they said, look, we are right. We cannot have corruption in our elections in Montana. And that decision by the Montana Supreme Court has been enjoined by the U.S. Supreme Court until they make a final decision on Montana's plea.
Right.
But So the interesting thing is what we've got is we have an initiative here in Montana, and that initiative does a couple of things. It reaffirms that corporations are not people. And of course, I think we'll all believe that a corporation's a person when they execute one in Texas.
Right.
Until then, nobody's going to believe it. So in Montana, we say a corporation is not a person. That's what this initiative says. And then number two, we get it. We get it that if the Supreme Court rules that it's going to take a constitutional amendment, and so this initiative is going to be the Montana citizens voting to instruct the Montana legislators in Washington, D.C., our two senators and our congressmen, to get behind a constitutional amendment that says corporations aren't persons and they can no longer bribe their way into the White House all the way to the courthouse.
Right, which would imply that money, the other half of that is that the Supreme Court's assertion that money is not actually property, it's actually somehow speech. I've got a pocket full of speech here. And so you're presumably asserting that as well, that's a fallacy.
Let me tell you what money is in politics. It's power.
Yeah.
How else can you explain that somebody who's going to make $180,000 as a member of Congress has to raise $50 million to get elected?
Yep.
I'll get you a $2 calculator, and you run those numbers, and you've got to conclude that the people that are putting that money down are expecting something in return. And what do they get in return? The military-industrial complex, the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, and others, they have now created a tax loophole system so they can gouge American citizens and not pay any taxes in the United States because they offshore all of the profits.
Yeah. We need a lot more a lot more Democratic politicians talking like you are, Governor Schweitzer. We're talking with the governor of the great state of Montana, Brian Schweitzer. The website is governor.mt.gov, G-O-V. And Governor, what you said that the Montana Supreme Court, which has said that this law that goes back to when the Copper Kings basically ruled Montana and used to openly bribe politicians, 1912, as I recall?
1912, yep. We passed the Anti-Corruption Act in Montana, which says corporations can't be involved in elections. They can't financially be involved. And then we put low limits. My gosh, to get elected to the Montana legislature, the maximum you can take from an individual is $160, and there's no corporate money. Well,
wow.
That worked fine for us in Montana. We had a pure democratic system, one person, one vote, lasted for 100 years. Little did we know that we apparently were violating the Constitution according to this bought and paid for United States Supreme Court.
Yeah, amen. And you said that they have enjoined this decision by the Montana Supreme Court, that law not only is constitutional, but the Montana Supreme Court attached a long list of proofs of the harms that come from corruption in the history of Montana. Enjoined is fancy lawyer talk for basically they've stopped it, which means that, correct me if I'm wrong, which means that Karl Rove and his buddies can now bring hundreds of millions of dollars if they want into your state and dump it into any political race they want.
Dirty, secret, corporate, foreign money will be dumped in Montana's elections much the same as it is in the rest of the world. Look, yeah. We had our fill of it when our first United States Senator, William A. Clark, one of the two richest people in the world, the two copper kings at the turn of the century, Marcus Daly and William A. Clark, number one and number two, William A. Clark decided he wanted to be in the U.S. Senate. So in 1899, when Montana was able to first send our United States Senator, we became a state in 1889. He actually let it well be known widely that he would give $10,000 cash money to any Montana legislator that would vote to send him to the U.S. Supreme Court. Remember, in those days, we didn't directly elect our U.S. senators.
Right.
And so he had his henchmen standing just off the floor of the Montana State Senate, and as they walked off the floor, they handed them an envelope, and there was $1,000 bills in them, 10 of them. They used to have $1,000 bills, and they put those in their pockets, and they sent him off to Washington, D.C. He got back to Washington, D.C. The rest of the Senate wouldn't seat him. They said, you can't pay $10,000 to a legislator to get elected. Why, we got in here for $200-$300 per legislator. It was Mark Twain who called William A. Clark the largest scoundrel in the history of the United States Senate, and then he followed by saying, and that's saying something.
Yeah.
So he bribed his way into the United States Senate, and they didn't like it that he was actually bragging about it in his newspaper and that he gave the money to these folks in the light of day, and these legislators were bragging about the money that they got from him.
Right.
They
so said, the people
oh, no,
rose
don't
up.
Talk about this.
So the people rose up and pressured the legislature to pass this law in 1912 that the Supreme Court has temporarily knocked
actually,
down.
Actually, in 1912, it was passed by referendum. It took the citizens to stand up. It wasn't even the legislature. They were bought and paid for. Why the hell would they vote against their own self-interest?
Sure, Sure.
It was the citizens of Montana who stood up.
Thank you for this history lesson. So where do you think this is going to go? I mean, the Supreme Court has put your state's law on hold.
Well, where it goes is probably in this election cycle, we're going to elect a few crooked politicians like they have the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. And now we effectively have two political parties in the United States, the corporate party and the corporate light party. So we're fixed up for good.
Yeah. Not so much, actually. But, it seems to me that this might be a real turning point, though. I wrote a book on corporate personhood 12 years ago, and outside of law schools, nobody had any interest in it. It's now a bestseller. People are waking up to this issue.
Well, look, and people understand that we don't want foreigners having a role in elections in the United States. Everybody agrees to that.
Right.
Everybody agrees to that. But now what we've got is the ability of foreigners to buy in corporate stock. I mean, you can't limit the people all over the world. They can buy into corporations, and now you effectively have foreign money that are buying elections in the United States. Again, what could go wrong?
So well said. Governor Brian Schweitzer of Montana, thank you, sir, for being with us today.
Stand up.
Indeed. Good luck. Initiative 166 in Montana. If you are in Montana, get thee there. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's remarkable. It is so cool to hear a politician just speaking blunt truth. We will be right back.
Given the wild wind for brother, in the wild Montana sky.
Yeah, in memory, or not memory, and thanks to Brian Schweitzer for dropping in here and spending some time with us and just going off on Citizens United and the Supreme Court. Brad Woodhouse is on the line with us now. He is the communications director for the DNC, BarackObama.com, of course, the website du jour. And the tale of two bus tours just wrapped up in Michigan. Well, welcome, Brad.
It sure did. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell me about this.
Well, we heard Mitt Romney was going to be leaving the Northeast, traveling across Pennsylvania and the Midwest, and anybody that's watched Mitt Romney for the past year knows that anytime he's out there on the stump, he's going to be distorting the president's record, and he's also going to be talking about his own and his own policies, but he's not really going to be talking about things that people need to know about. So
yeah, well, I will use language that you won't, because I say this every single day. The only way Mitt Romney can win the White House is by lying.
Well, I think that's one way to put it. And the New York Times recently noted that, his stump speeches are nothing more than a bunch of talking points that aren't supported by the facts. And,
he had
an interesting tour here. He went to a bunch of states whose economies are really beginning to move, really beginning to thrive. And, Iowa's got a 5.1% unemployment rate. Michigan's unemployment rate is nearly half what it was when the president took office. Ohio's unemployment rate has gone down for 10 consecutive months. But he's out there telling people that the president made the economy worse, and it doesn't comport with people's reality. I mean, we all know that the economy needs to be doing better. But what he's saying is flatly untrue.
Yeah. Well, and at the same time, the Republican governors around the United States have laid off 250,000 teachers. I mean, they've laid off 600,000 government employees, 100,000 cops. I mean, all these people who have been laid off by these Republican governors, and this is kind of like austerity in Europe, and it's killing the economies of Europe. They're starting to wake up, and the people are starting to push back. I haven't heard a lot coming out of the White House or the DNC calling out the Republicans on trying to basically, not even trying, on succeeding in crashing the economy. I mean, if these public employees were still working, the unemployment rate right now nationally would be 7.2%.
Well, I will tell you, we made that point, and of course this has been a back and forth between our two campaigns. When Mitt Romney came out a week or so ago and belittled the president's jobs plan, which would help states keep teachers, firefighters, and police on the job. I mean, he seems to think he seems to think that the solution to the economy is to fire teachers, firefighters and police. And, you know, when I was in Ohio on this tour that we did over the weekend, one of the things I said was that John Boehner and Paul Ryan and these other Republican members, that were riding around with Mitt Romney on the bus should get their butts back to Washington and help pass the president's jobs plan. Yeah. But they won't do that. And they won't do that because they are more interested in winning an election than they are putting the American people back to work. And the truth is that it's not going to be lost on people when they go to the polls that Republicans in the House that run the House have done everything they could to run the clock out and to stall this economy so that Mitt Romney can win the White House. I do not believe they're going to be rewarded with that, by the way.
It seems to me, Brad Woodhouse, communications director for the DNC, that one of the huge smoking guns here that you guys should be using in a big way, and I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job.
Yeah.
Maybe you already are, but I mean, obviously you're doing your job. Maybe you're already using this. Is this meeting that Robert Draper outed in his new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do,
was
January 20th, 2009, the night of the inauguration. These 14 Republicans got together, including five senators and the rest of members of the House of Representatives, including Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor, and basically took a blood oath to destroy any economic legislation that the president tries to pass. In fact, afterwards, one of the members who was there, Pete Sessions, said that their behavior should be modeled on the Taliban. He said, Taliban insurgency, we understand perhaps a little more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire process. We need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side being you guys. Is it part of your plan to point out that this has been a strategy literally from the day the president was sworn into office?
Well, we have talked about that. We've talked about that very incident. We've also talked about how Mitch McConnell has, you know, said that his number one priority was defeating the president. I mean, he's supposed to be legislating over there in the, you know, in the Senate, not the Republicans ever do that over there. But absolutely, I think one of the things that we need to do is challenge the media for not focusing on this more. Why did John Boehner walk away from a grand bargain with the president last summer? Because you know what? Had they reached a true agreement on a balanced approach that included revenue and cuts and some investments in job creating programs to deal with the debt and deficit in a balanced way, it would have helped the economy.
Yeah, but that's half of the two reasons why. I mean, one of the reasons was that it would have helped the economy. People would have been put back to work and President Obama would get credit for it. And the other is that if he went against multimillionaire lobbyist Grover Norquist,
mm-hmm.
and the Koch brothers who fund him, his political career would be toast.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, in that case, I think you saw a whole host of House Republicans putting their political careers above doing what's right for the country. I mean, one thing you can say about this president is he's willing to make tough calls, and he's made calls that have not always been popular with his supporters. He's made calls that have not always been popular with the American people. Most all of them have proved to be correct. For example, the automobile industry rescue. But Republicans never make tough calls. I mean, Mitt Romney's on the campaign trail today, won't answer a question about where he is on women's issues, in particular where he is on stuff like the Fair Pay Act. He won't answer a question about, well, you didn't like what the president did last Friday on immigration, but what would you do about it as president? He won't answer that question.
He won't specify which tax loophole he's going to close.
That's exactly right.
And one of the tax loopholes that might be useful to close is the one that helped make him $300 million.
That's right.
Amazing.
That's exactly
Brad Woodhouse right. With the DNC, BarackObama.com. Thank you for coming on, sir.
Hey, thank you. Anytime.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Well, it's good to hear a Democrat with some fire in his belly. We'll be right back. Welcome back. And this is pretty amazing. If you're inclined to call a senator and just, you know, occasionally ask a snarky question or even a genuine and serious question, you might want to think about calling Jeff Sessions, this strange fellow from Alabama. He's kind of an odd looking guy as well as odd behaving, but you can't really knock somebody for their looks. Although Abraham Lincoln once made the point that You can't control your parents, but the face that you end up with as an adult, you've helped make. In any case, Jeff Sessions is saying that he wants to, he just gave a speech on the floor of the Senate, he wants to drop the average monthly amount of food stamps that people get in the United States from the current rate of $133.84. This is for a family. Now, first of all, if you can feed a family for $133 a month, you're doing damn well. He wants to drop that down to $43.84 a month. Not buy, but two. $43. Well, you can feed your family on, this is what, $1.20 a day? For three meals? You're supposed to buy what? Well, you can always eat dirt, you know? So if you think that that's a little odd, you can go to callcongress.org and see the phone numbers for the switchboard there at Congress, and you can give Jeff Sessions a call and just, really? He says he wants to do it to get fraud out of the system. Some guy who won a lottery, who was apparently very poor after he won the lottery, continued getting food stamps. Now, my guess would be that the mail just kept coming. But so what? I mean, how many people drive drunk in America every year? What do you think, a million? I mean, 50,000 die from it. So there's fraud, arguably, in our automotive system because some people drive drunk. Does that mean that we should just outlaw driving? Because some people misuse it? You know, you could extend this metaphor to just about anything. Oh, there was a restaurant in New York a couple of years ago where this was actually in the news. It was an ethnic restaurant, as I recall. It was from a country where eating rats is not all that unusual. It was serving rats and cats. Oh, well, let's just stop all restaurants. After all, somebody's misusing the system. I mean, come on. Oh, here, Shane has a nice little clip for us from that oracle of intelligent thinking, Sean Hannity.
People have struggled financially, or they live check to check and month to month to pay the rent. I've done that, but I never went to bed hungry in my life, ever. Most Americans haven't. You can go shopping, you can get things. For example, I have friends of mine that eat rice and beans all the time. Beans, protein, rice, inexpensive. It's real, and you can make a big pot of this for a week for relatively negligible amounts of money.
Well, there you go. This is the Jeff Sessions program. $48 a month to feed your entire family. You buy a 25-pound bag of rice and a 25-pound bag of beans. You probably could. And when your children grow up nutritionally deficient and neurological disorders and you know, only 3.5 feet tall and whatever, I mean, you know, they sort of look like Jeff Sessions, I guess. In any case, it's just, I find this beyond horrific. Jerry in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
I hate your bumper music.
Well, my apologies.
Well, anyway, what I wanted to ask you was why the Democrats are not pointing out that we give these millionaires tax breaks to create jobs in this country. And Romney's got a couple hundred million in the Bahamas, and I don't know what he's got in the Cayman Islands.
And some in Switzerland, yeah.
And, well, I understand he closed his Swiss bank account.
Oh, yeah, recently, yeah. He took $100 million and gave it to his sons. Now, if I gave more than $10,000, I believe that's the limit. I don't know because I haven't tested this, but I know it used to be the limit. You can give up to $10,000 to a family member, and it's not a taxable event. But over $10,000, you have to pay, either they have to pay income taxes, you have to pay, so there's some kind of tax on it, right, if you give it to your kids.
Yeah.
But Romney has four sons, and he gave them $100 million, and they're paying no tax on it, he's paying no tax on it. Apparently, it has to do with laundering it through a Cayman's Island account or something like that. I mean, it's like he lives in a universe that I don't even understand. Right. I've run businesses. I've made a fair amount of money in my life. It's a different world that he's in. This is a guy who walks into a Wawa, into a fast food store, convenience store, or gas station thing, and is amazed by the fact that you can touch screen a panel and a sandwich will come out. Holy cow. Here, just listen to this, Jerry.
I was at Wawa's. I went in to order a sandwich. You press a little touch tone keypad, all right? You just touch that, and, the sandwich comes in. You touch this, go pay the cashier. There's your sandwich. It's amazing.
It's amazing. I mean, it's incredible. He's just, clearly never seen a vending machine before because billionaires don't have, multimillionaire people worth $400-500 million. Well, he's worth a little less than that because he gave $100 million of it to his kids. People worth $250 million don't tend to hang out in stores or motels where, 7-8 o'clock at night and you want a snack, you go outside and hit the vending machine. What can I say?
It's strange to me. I mean, he's got that money that he's made in this country.
Yeah.
And he's supposed to use it.
Well, he didn't make it all.
Jobs,
he didn't,
you know.
Yeah, he didn't make it all in this country. I mean, several of the companies that he built up, and he likes to talk about Staples. I built Staples, yeah. Well, walk into a Staples and see if you can find anything made in America.
Worse than Walmart, huh?
Right. This guy's making his money in China. It's just, it's the Romney way. Anyhow, Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Chip in Unionville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Chip, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great.
Go back to the wench back there in whatever state it was talking about President Obama with the monkey ears.
Oh, yeah, this was in Phoenix, Arizona.
That was totally disgusting. Disgusting.
Yes, sir.
I cannot believe that anybody in this country would talk about our president like that.
Yeah.
And,
well, but you better believe it, because it is not just happening, but this woman was, did a talk show with the former head of the Arizona Republican Party.
I know. And that whole freaking party is tearing this country down.
Well, I think that the Republican Party has been hijacked from within by, a front group that is fronting for a small number of very cranky, very wealthy billionaires
it bothers me really bad. I'm like, I don't have any kids. I'm glad I don't.
Ouch.
But I don't know what I would tell them with this world today.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you the Republican Party is not the Republican Party that my father was a member of, and it's a sad thing, and I wish sane Republicans would take back their party. Sean in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to point out what the governor was saying from Montana about money and foreign money in our politics. Well, I want to add that when you had Republicans and white-collared CEOs of manufacturing jobs, which was in my area, we were the epicenter, shipped them all over to communist China. That would have not have flown in the Cold War, that we shipped all them jobs to Soviet Russia. This all is high treason in my book.
Yeah, well, the major state sponsor of Vietnam when we were fighting that war was communist China. I mean, there certainly was a time in America where that would not have happened, And frankly, the only country who has had a senior military official threaten to nuke the United States in the last couple of decades that I can recall is communist China. And on the one hand, this sounds like, I guess, China bashing. And I really don't want to do that, because I think that we need to be in a world where we're living with all the countries of the world and we're trying to move them all in a more positive direction. And frankly, they're trying to move us in a more positive direction. I mean, China is pointing out that, we have problems with human rights. Look at the racial composition of our prisons, for example. or look at the lack of health care in the United States, and on and on. I mean, they point these things out. So it's like, you know, here we are in glass houses. But this is Sean, thank you for the call. This is how Romney makes his money. This is how a lot of these, and Shirley Adelson making all this money in Macau, which is a Chinese territory. It's like Hong Kong. And then bringing that money over here to hand $100 million of it to Mitt Romney. Say, yeah, run for president. What's going on with this?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think somewhat more nationalistic previous generations of Americans would not have tolerated that.
You spend millions on elections like a real person would. If they could, and we're citizens united.
There you go. John Kenneth Galbraith, Tom in Minneapolis, sent this to me. I now have it taped on the wall here in front of me. The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is, the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. And our talk radio news service is on the line. Who would that be? Oh, it's Ellen Ratner.
Ellen Ratner.
Okay.
Today.
Our talk radio news service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. What's up, Ellen?
Well, actually, speaking about that, you know, as you know, the president yesterday met with Chancellor Merkel. Today at the G20, they did issue a statement saying that they are going to support things, and they're going to, in fact, support the Spanish banks. So, and without it looking like they're going to do a lot of austerity. I mean, obviously, they're going to do some, but I think they realize politically they can't just do that and kind of get away with it. I mean, it happened in Greece, but Greece really has their sort of their selves in a vise. And, of course, what's interesting is that the United States, today, there has been a lot of discussion about exactly what the U.S. is going to do. And I think it'll be interesting, really, to see if the Congress comes around. Now, there have been several people today on various airwaves saying the U.S. is not going to come around, that nothing will get done by the elections. And also what's interesting in terms of the election today is that you have a situation where Marco Rubio, has apparently not been asked for his credentials. Now, ABC reported that. Very, very interesting.
So this is the Romney campaign not just deciding in advance that they weren't going to consider, I think that there's just this general sense among the Republican Party that they're not so into Hispanics, but not only deciding that they're not going to consider him, but insulting him by rubbing it in his face and not even extending the courtesy to him that they extended to a bunch of other people of saying, yeah, you know, fill out these forms so we can check you out because we're thinking about
unless
you.
Unless he's doing that as a bait and switch at the final moment. But, you know, the time is getting very, very close to vet somebody. So that's kind of interesting. Also, the House, there are going to be votes this afternoon on a special environmental bill. The Democrats are not happy. And the bill authorizes the hunting of sea lions in the Pacific Northwest. They say it's for endangered fish population. It permits greater use of federal funds by states to acquire and establish public target shooting ranges on federal lands.
Yikes.
It doubles the duration of grazing permits on federal lands and allows off-road vehicles in Cape Hatteras recreation areas. Hydropower is going to be expanded, all of that kind of thing.
Amazing. So a national park gets to be filled with lead and gunpowder.
You got it.
And forget about, you know, going to the Grand Canyon for a little peace and quiet. It's like, Doc!
Also, I don't know if you've been reporting the Julian Assange stuff.
I haven't mentioned that, and we need to. So you do it.
basically what happened is he applied for asylum at the Ecuador embassy.
In the UK, in London.
Sting?
Pardon?
This was announced in Ecuador by the foreign minister. Yes.
Huh?
Gets it. Now, whether London will allow him safe passage out of there, like China did, when they were, went to the Chinese, went to the American embassy in China, I don't know. Truth and honesty, my brother is one of his attorneys, so I just like to say that.
Your brother Michael is one of Julian Assange's lawyers?
Yes.
Wow. Well, tell him we'd love to get him on this, either him or Julian Assange, on the program to talk about it.
Well, I will. I will. I asked him for a Julian Assange interview, but, you know, brother Michael wasn't forthcoming.
Yeah. Well, he's his lawyer, you know. So.
After the Tuesday caucus lunches, Speaker Boehner said that immigration reform was going to be more difficult. He said it puts everybody in a difficult position. He said the president can't talk about his economic policies. He can't talk about the number one issue on the minds of the Americans because his policies have failed. He's turned the politics of envy and division, which I don't think American people are going to accept. Excuse me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. you know, more than half of Americans, Ellen, now will tell a pollster that they believe that the Republicans are intentionally trying to crash the economy and have been for 3 years to deny Obama a second term. It's becoming increasingly obvious.
I doubt it. Senator Leahy and Grassley have asked the Supreme Court to televise court proceedings when they announce the decision on affordable health care. You and I know that is not going to happen.
Congress can mandate that, though, you know. The Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says that the Supreme Court must operate under rules established by Congress. Congress can simply pass a law that says that the Supreme Court must have cameras, and they must have. There's no way that they can stop it.
I don't think they're going to do that.
No, I know that they're not going to do it because everybody lives in terror of the nine kings of America, you know, three blocks down the road here from us.
Politicians in black robes.
Yes.
Russia does not insure its own cargo ships. The British dropped their insurance of the Russian ship that was carrying weapons to Syria. The company is Standard Club. Mm-hmm. That happened today.
Okay, so that's interrupting the flow of weapons into Syria.
That's right. That's what they're trying to do. Mitch McConnell this morning was on TV. He said a grand bargain is possible if the White House will come to the table with entitlement reform. He said he wants eligibility changes. He says that if taxes had been increased, the economy would have come to a halt.
Remarkable. Okay, Ellen Ratner, this Talk Radio News Service report. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
This report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Up next, did you know that San Onofre, the nuclear power plant, had a leak that blew out radiation, and that the NRC finally decided just this week it's a design flaw? Well, actually, Kevin Camp's going to tell us the whole story right after this. This is a horrible story.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, two things. Before I start off on my You Need to Know This rant, I want to share with you one additional piece. This hour is going to be all about the Constitution and all about the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has ruled, as you know, in Citizens United, that billionaires have all the rights, basically, and you and I got nothing. That, you know, whoever has the most money gets the most speech because money is speech and all that kind of stuff. And I think you can make a very strong argument that that is not a Republican form of government. Now, by referring to it as a Republican form of government, I'm using 18th century language, which is arguably still applicable, although widely misunderstood. But the small r Republican form of government, keep in mind, when Thomas Jefferson formed what we call the Democratic Party today, it was in opposition to the Federalists. The Federalists were the conservatives of the day. No, just leave it where it was. And Jefferson started this thing called the Democratic Republicans. In fact, during the George Bush administration, WhiteHouse.gov said that Thomas Jefferson was the founder of the Republican Party. Or let me rephrase that. That Thomas Jefferson founded the Democratic Republican Party as if he was the founder of the Republican Party. Actually, it said Thomas Jefferson founded the Republican Party. Yeah, it did say that. And I wrote several op-eds about it. I used to rant about it at length because they dropped the word Republican in the late 1820s, early 1830s. Just after Jefferson died, and just called it the Democratic Party, which it's still called today. It's the longest lasting political party in the history of the world. But the reason that he had the word Republican on there was because Republican means responsive to the people. And the Federalists were just about, you know, they were kind of about royalty, as it were, you know, without getting into all the vagaries of language back there. The reason I'm saying all this is that a Republican form of government requires everybody participating. Article 4, and you've got all these modern-day Republican Party hacks, and now we know that the Republican Party is funding this thing in Wisconsin to basically make it harder and in some cases impossible for elderly people to vote who are concerned about Medicare and Social Security, for students to vote, more concerned about school debt and access to education, for urban people living in cities to vote who don't own cars, who rely on mass transportation. I mean, here in D.C., the Republicans in Congress are trying to cut $150 million out of our transportation budget. I take the metro every day. They're trying to take away my trains. Okay. So in a Republican form of government, we would be able to say something about that. So here, Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution says, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican form of government. You are guaranteed a Republican form of government. And I would submit to you that if the Koch brothers are buying laws, or the Republican Party, for that matter, is buying laws in the state of Wisconsin or anywhere else, that's a violation of the Constitution. And a tip of the hat to Michael, who shared this with me out of Portland State. Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution. Now, here's another one. Way back in 1803, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase really stepped in it. Thomas Jefferson was the president at the time. And his supporters in Congress, as I said, called themselves the Democratic Republicans. Jefferson's chief political rival was John Adams, who he defeated in the election of 1800. Adams led the Federalists against the Democratic Republicans. The Federalists fought hard to protect the wealthy elite, and they succeeded, in fact, when the Constitution was being written, in eliminating the direct election of U.S. senators by we the people. And there were people who suggested at that time, hey, this isn't a Republican form of government. Big fight. Now, while you can't compare them apples to apples, the Federalists are basically today's Republican Party, at least in their belief that society is best organized when there's a wealthy ruling elite at the top. Now enters Samuel Chase. Samuel Chase was appointed to the High Court in 1796. That would have been the year that John Adams ran for election. It would have been the last year of the George Washington administration. George Washington was a Federalist. John Adams was a Federalist. Samuel Chase proudly called himself a Federalist. So Thomas Jefferson was already a little uneasy with Samuel Chase as a Supreme Court justice because this guy was from the other party. And after Chase joined other Federalists on the Supreme Court to create judicial review in the 1803 Marbury versus Madison case, this was exclusively a Federalist thing, which gave the court the power to strike down laws passed by both Congress and the president, making the Supreme Court the most powerful, the most unaccountable of the three branches of government. Jefferson went nuts. His anger with the court and with Samuel Chase was really intense. So later in 1803, the third year of Jefferson's presidency, or the second year, actually, it started in 1801, when Samuel Chase went in front of a Baltimore grand jury and publicly criticized President Thomas Jefferson and his party, the Democratic Republicans, for trying to, get this, for trying to expand voter rights, Jefferson had enough. Chase argued that the policies being advanced by Jefferson and the Democratic Republicans to give more men the right to vote would, and here's an actual quote, rapidly destroy all protection to property and all security to personal liberty, and our Republican Constitution would sink into mobocracy, the worst of all possible governments. The modern doctrines by our late reformers that all men in a state of society are entitled to enjoy equal liberty and equal rights have brought this mighty mischief upon us. How dare they suggest equal liberty and equal rights? And I fear that it will rapidly destroy progress until peace and order, freedom and property shall be destroyed. You get it? The Federalists did not want mobocracy. They didn't want everybody to vote. They just wanted rich white guys to vote. And Thomas Jefferson was trying to at least get poor white guys voting. And it made a sitting justice on the Supreme Court crazy. This is a blatant political act against President Thomas Jefferson, a sitting U.S. president, by a sitting Supreme Court justice who was supposed to be politically impartial. And it was just the latest in a long series of politically motivated decisions by Samuel Chase. In 1796, Chase made several speeches, campaign speeches, for Federalist John Adams when he was running for president. That would be like a Supreme Court justice going on the campaign trail and telling people to vote for Mitt Romney today. Chase openly supported passage of the Alien and Sedition Act in 1798, which gave President Adams the power to jail his rivals. Chase even used his power as judge to give harsher sentences to Jefferson's Democratic Republican supporters in court. So after Chase went out and publicly ridiculed the president in 1803 over voter reforms, Jefferson and his allies in the House of Representatives basically said, enough is enough. Thomas Jefferson, here was Thomas Jefferson taking all of this baloney from a sitting justice in the United States Supreme Court who was fighting Jefferson over expanding the voting franchise. And so in 1804, they decided to do something about Samuel Chase. And I'll tell you about that right after the break, because I think it's something that maybe Mr. Scalia should be thinking about right now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can look it up. 1804, House of Representatives, Samuel Chase, Supreme Court Justice. I'll tell you the whole story right after this.
It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Tell me that you don't care. Crazy, crazy, crazy.
Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Okay, so in 1804, I was telling you the story of Samuel Chase, this guy who was appointed to the Supreme Court the last year of the George Washington administration. He was a Federalist. He was the opposite party from President Jefferson, who was president from 1808. He was elected in the election of 1800 and replaced by James Madison in the election of 1808, but he served from 1801 to 1809. And so 1804. Samuel Chase is out campaigning. He had been 6 years earlier campaigning for, or 8 years earlier, campaigning for John Adams, the Federalist. 6 years earlier had supported John Adams in the Alien Sedition Acts so that John Adams could shut down over 30 newspapers, put Benjamin Franklin Bok, Ben Franklin's grandson, in prison for writing an op-ed in which Benjamin Franklin Bok said that President Adams was old, toothless, querulous, and balding. Yes, he got put in prison for saying that. And Samuel Chase was right there supporting him on the Supreme Court, supporting John Adams in doing that. So finally, in 1804, Chase's partisan conduct on the court, he actually was hitting people who came before the court, because back then the Supreme Court didn't decide issues of constitutionality. They did that only twice in the entire time from the founding of the Republic until the Andrew Jackson presidency. So back then, the Supreme Court was like the final court of appeals. So somebody sold somebody 20 chickens, and one of them died, and the guy sues, and it ends up before the Supreme Court. Seriously. And if the guy before the Supreme Court was a Federalist, Samuel Chase gave him a light sentence or ruled in his side. And if he was a Democratic Republican, Samuel Chase gave him worse charges. So in 1804, the House of Representatives impeached Samuel Chase on charges of judicial misconduct. And to this day, Samuel Chase is the only Supreme Court justice to ever have been impeached. Ultimately, Chase remained on the bench. He escaped getting kicked off by the skin of his teeth. You get impeached in the House. You get convicted in the Senate. The Senate failed to muster the two-thirds majority necessary to remove Chase from the Supreme Court. So he served on the bench for seven more years before dying of a heart attack in 1811. And that's the story of Samuel Chase. But in 1982, Samuel Chase was reincarnated when Ronald Reagan appointed Antonin Scalia to be a justice on the United States Supreme Court. And yesterday, in his dissenting opinion against the majority's decision to strike down three out of four provisions in Arizona's controversial anti-immigration laws, Justice Antonin Scalia had his Samuel Chase moment. He went unhinged. He publicly ripped President Obama for not enforcing immigration laws. Just a few days after the president had announced that the nation would no longer deport young undocumented immigrants who were brought here as children and are now in school or working or in the military keeping their noses clean. Scalia said, quote, "To say, as this court does, that Arizona contradicts federal law by enforcing applications of the Immigration Act that the president declines to enforce boggles the mind. If securing its territory in this fashion is not within the power of Arizona, we should cease referring to it as a sovereign state." So, in 1803, Justice Samuel Chase criticized the president for trying to expand voter rights and got impeached. In 2012, Justice Antonin Scalia criticized the president for trying to save young undocumented immigrants from deportation. But there's virtually no chance he'll be impeached. But it goes beyond Scalia's comments on immigration. The guy has a history of tarnishing the integrity of the Supreme Court. Scalia is the justice who went on a duck hunting trip back in 2005 with Vice President Dick Cheney, right before deciding to hear a case against Dick Cheney and then ruling in favor of Dick Cheney. Scalia also went on a hunting trip with the dean of the Kansas Law School and then agreed to hear two cases in which that very same dean was the lead attorney. According to federal law, any justice must recuse himself from a case, must step back and say, "I'm not going to rule on this case," when his impartiality might be questioned. It's called the Federal Code of Judicial Conduct. And just like how Justice Samuel Chase refused to recuse himself in cases dealing with political allies, the Federalists, or his political enemies, the Democratic Republicans, ultimately leading to his impeachment, Justice Scalia is guilty of the same impeachable behavior. Chase was also slammed for campaigning on behalf of John Adams. But Scalia today has attended and spoken at political conventions hosted by the Koch brothers, major supporters and founders of today's Republican Party. And Scalia refused to recuse himself from the Citizens United case despite the Koch brothers' ties to political advocacy groups that benefited immensely from Scalia's decision in Citizens United. So the point of all this, the point is that Justice Antonin Scalia needs to be impeached. Just as Justice Samuel Chase was impeached back in 1803 for demonstrating a similar lack of integrity and impartiality while serving on the high court. If we are truly going to have an independent judiciary with the task of impartially interpreting the Constitution, then there's no longer any room for Justice Scalia on the court. It is time for Congress to do its constitutionally defined job. And it is defined repeatedly in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 2, Clause 5. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers and shall have the sole power of impeachment. Article 1, Section 3, Clauses 6 and 7. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. Judgment cases of impeachments. It goes on. Anyway, Article 2, Section 4, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment, and civil officers would include the justices of the Supreme Court, shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. This is the one that they went after President Clinton on. Now tell me, Antonin Scalia doing fundraisers for the Koch brothers and then ruling in their favor is not as big a deal? In fact, is not a bigger deal than a president having consensual sex with an adult outside of his marriage and then lying about it? Article 3, Section 1. The judges, both of the Supreme and Inferior Court, shall hold their offices during good behavior.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It is time to impeach Antonin Scalia. And I'd add Clarence Thomas to that as well. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very disantaneously ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, 1-888 Eco Wine. The good. The U.S. District Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Yesterday, the court rejected a challenge from Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli that argued climate change does not have a damaging impact on the environment and human health. Cuccinelli has been fighting the claim ever since the EPA officially came out with it in 2009. He argued that the EPA used flawed research to come up with the finding. In other words, Cuccinelli is just another far-right climate change-denying conservative. Fact of the matter is, thanks to America's obsession with fossil fuels, global climate change and global warming are very real and need to be addressed. Kudos to the U.S. Court of Appeals for seeing the reality behind climate change. The bad. The Texas Republican Party. Remember how we told you about the absurd party platform of the Iowa Republican Party? Well, it looks like the Texas Republican Party is trying to one-up them. Among the absurdities in the newly released Texas GOP platform is a call to repeal one of the most important pieces of legislation in American history, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The act outlawed the discriminatory voting practices that had prevented many African Americans from being able to vote in the United States. It appears that the Texas GOP wants to go back to the days when only wealthy white landowners had a say in the American democracy. And the very, very ugly Arizona Congressman Jeff Flake. Flake, a Republican and current Arizona Senate candidate, was once a lobbyist who lobbied to protect South Africa's apartheid government. In 1987, Flake was a lobbyist for a Namibian uranium mine and testified before the Utah State Senate about a resolution backing the South African apartheid government. He argued that in order to protect American uranium interests in the region, the mineral that is the building block of nuclear power and nuclear weapons, we needed to support the white supremacist government. So Flake put the interests of corporate greed and access to nuclear weapons and power ahead of human rights and social justice. And that is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. It's really pretty incredible. Oh, my. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Keith in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Keith, what's on your mind?
Well, I was just wanting to let you know, I didn't agree with the way you're portraying the, Republican conservatives, of which I have been one for over 20 years. Your rant about, Justice Scalia, I just see as sour grapes. I mean, it's the same thing I hear from our party members, when there's a Democrat in office. If a vote doesn't go their way, they're obviously politically motivated, just like when a vote doesn't go your way, you know, they're politically motivated. It seems to just be a case of sour grapes.
It is very rare that a Supreme Court justice calls out the President of the United States. And it's even more rare that a Supreme Court justice openly, blatantly, and flagrantly violates the Federal Code of Judicial Ethics. I mean, to go duck hunting with two different people who had business before the court and then rule in their favor before the court, how is that not impeachable, Keith? How is that not good behavior?
There again, you know, it's nothing that doesn't happen every day. And I'm sure that...
No, I'm sorry, it doesn't. It's a federal felony. It's a crime.
I'm sure.
Federal judges would go to prison for this.
Okay. And I'm sure that some of the Democratic, the more liberal justices have done things with senators and congressmen and business.
No, they haven't. They haven't. If they, I'm telling you, if they had, the Republicans would have raised absolute holy stink about it. It has not happened. I mean, you had Daddy Coke out there trying to impeach Earl Warren, who, as I recall, was actually put on the court by Eisenhower. But in any case, trying to impeach Earl Warren for years because Earl Warren ruled in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. And I guarantee you, if Earl Warren had ever gone to dinner with somebody who was working on behalf of civil rights, Daddy Coke would have been all over it, and we would all know the mantra. No, it does not happen. What has happened here is that Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, with his wife working for the Heritage Foundation, actually sending out emails to Republicans when her husband took the case of Bush v. Gore, which stopped the recount in Florida, which they knew would, you know, throw the election to Bush. Sending out emails to Republicans asking, would you like to work in the Bush White House before the election had been decided? I mean, Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, I think both of them are it's just wrong. John, listening to AM 950 in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good.
I first want to start off by telling you I'm an independent, and I really listen to both sides, and I hear a lot of blaming the other side and blaming them for everything while simultaneously excusing almost anything their side does. And sitting here in the middle, I see both sides. So I've been listening to you talk about Scalia and how he's kind of not following his constitutional duties, and I'll agree with you, especially regarding some of that stuff, meeting with people he really shouldn't be meeting with. I could care less whether or not he criticized the president. But one thing I want to ask you is, how do you justify Obama's constitutional principles?
Obama's what?
Well, following his constitutional duty. He swore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution.
Right.
That he continued the Fourth Amendment repealing Patriot Act. He signed the worst piece of legislation I've ever heard of, the NDAA.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just the most un-American thing I've ever heard of.
You know, John, that was a piece of legislation. That's one of the few areas where I can't defend the president. There are things that I disagree with this president about. But I still, you know, I would like him to stay in office. But I think your primary beef is with Congress, because the legislation does not originate in the White House. It originates in the House of Representatives. Then it goes to the Senate. Then they agree on it. Then after they both agree on it, then it goes to the White House. So, you know, I would start there. But let me just share with you this just very quickly. Alexander Hamilton, Federalist Paper number 39. It is essential to such a government, right, our government, that it be derived from the great body of society, not from an inconsiderable portion or a favored class of it. Otherwise, a hand of tyrannical nobles exercising their oppressions by a delegation of their powers might aspire to the rank of Republicans and claim for their government the honorable title of Republic. In other words, you know, we all need to be involved in this thing. Marbury versus Madison, after that was decided in 1803 and the Supreme Court took on all this power, Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to Patrick Henry's father-in-law, Spencer Roane, judge of the Virginia Supreme Court. If this opinion be sound, Jefferson wrote, then indeed is our Constitution a complete felo de se, legally a suicide, for intending to establish three departments coordinated and independent that they might check and balance one another, it has given, according to this opinion, to one of them alone the right to prescribe rules for the government of the others, and to that one, too, which is unelected by and independent of the nation. The Constitution, on this hypothesis, is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please. It should be remembered as an axiom of eternal truth in politics that whenever any power in government is independent, it is absolute also. My construction of the Constitution is very different. It is that each department is truly independent of the others and has an equal right to decide for itself what is the meaning of the Constitution in the cases submitted to its action, and especially where it is to act ultimately and without appeal. A judiciary, independent of a king or executive alone, is a good thing, but independent of the will of the nation is a solecism, which is a fancy old 19th century word for blunder, at least in a Republican government. End of quote. President Thomas Jefferson. Mike in Boynton Beach, Florida. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
So
my brother Alphonse and I are watching your show.
Well,
and
thank
as
you.
Far as the Supreme, thank you. We're big fans. As far as the Supreme Court justices, having just nine of them and appointing them for life, big mistake.
Yeah. Well, it's a big. Yeah. It's not a big mistake if they don't have the power to knock down things from the other two elected branches of government. But they took that power in 1803 during the Jefferson presidency to themselves. And I just shared with you what Thomas Jefferson thought about that. And I don't think anybody is going to question his bona fides as a founder of this country.
No, not at all. But I do say this, and I've said it to you before. Believe me, this is all on me, not you. My opinions are mine. But these guys who take office and hold the kind of power to destroy lives that are taxpayers or military people because they're in bed with corporations or they break the law, we all know that a capital punishment, death sentences for crime, they don't deter murder because a lot of it happens on the spur of the moment. But it could deter you from committing a crime when you know that you're going to have to pay a corporal punishment or what you're
like. Yeah, if you're going down that road, Mike, I'm not going to go there with you. Tom in Youngstown, Ohio. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Your opinion.
These guys have to, the whole bunch have to go. The whole structure of the Supreme Court has to be changed. These guys have been playing games with the American people for years.
Yeah.
And it has to be stopped.
I don't disagree. And this is, oddly enough, this is one of those areas where I agree with Phyllis Schlafly. In fact, she's been on this program. She wrote a book about it. And I agree with Newt Gingrich, who wrote a book about it. Both of them wrote books on judicial review and how it's unconstitutional. It is not. It was not the intent of the founders. You can read the constitutional, the minutes when the Constitution was written. It was not what they were planning. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So if you want a really radical constitutional amendment, how about one that says the Supreme Court does not have the power to determine the constitutionality of the law? That shall rest with Congress. Is welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States of America. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I hope your caller from Nashville a few callers ago was still listening. He seems to mix up the difference between a vote and a ruling from a judge.
The guy who said that the left-wing judges do it too?
Well, you know, he was just talking about how the left and the right, you know, complain about how, you know, when a vote doesn't go their way.
Right.
It's not a vote. It's a ruling.
Yes.
And there's a difference.
Yes.
And the problem with some of these conservatives is that they don't want freedom. They always talk about freedom. They want to be led. They want to be ruled over.
Well, this
I
is.
Don't.
Yeah, I agree. I don't either. Mike, thank you. Very well said. And in fact, John McCain wrote a book about this, Conservatives Without a Conscience, which is about the sheeple mentality of so many conservatives, tragically. Mitch in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Mitch, you're on the air.
Just real quickly, in case these cell phones are getting solar activity, Professor Jonathan Turley just recently wrote an editorial about enlarging the Supreme Court. He says there's nothing in the Constitution limiting how many people may be on the Supreme Court.
That's correct.
He says maybe we should expand it to 19 people, and to avoid packing the court, no president can appoint more than two at a time until the number is reached.
That's a good idea.
That's a good idea.
And, Mitch, thanks a lot for the call. And you're right. The Constitution, Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says that the court shall operate under regulations established by Congress. Congress defines how many members of the court there are. However, this is what Franklin Roosevelt tried to do in 1936. He tried to say any justice on the court, about half the court at that time, there were nine justices in the court at that time, about half of them were over 70. And what he wanted to do was pass a law through Congress, it was totally constitutional, that said that any justice over 70, all the justices over 70 in aggregate had one vote. So the four or five justices who were over 70, all of their votes became just one vote. And it was called the vote emeritus, right, the elder vote. And then additional justices would be added to the court by the president to bring it up to nine votes. And I just finished reading a book about 3 months ago about this time in this era. And there's a pretty strong consensus that if FDR had stuck by his guns, he would have won. But the firestorm, the political firestorm, was so intense. But what happened was then in the court in 1937, the next year, in the next judicial session, they actually started changing their opinions because they got how public opinion was, you know, largely, frankly, with Roosevelt. So, Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi. It's obvious that there would be no impeachment just because of who's in charge of the House right now.
That's correct.
And but what you're saying is if they're committing an act that is essentially, I don't know, is it a crime? Is there other options other than impeachment?
Yeah. One of the options, a very simple option, would be for Congress, with the power that they have under Article 3, Section 2, to simply pass a very, very simple law that says that the Code of Judicial Ethics, which applies to all federal judges, also applies to members of the Supreme Court. And that would mean that a lot of the behavior that Scalia and Thomas and Alito have engaged in showing up at Koch brothers fundraisers and things like that, would become criminal. Now, you can't do ex post facto laws. You can't reach back into the past by passing a law, but you can stop this behavior, you know, going forward, which really upset them tremendously. That would be a good starting point. I mean, Congress should have done that 150 years ago. So it probably wasn't a federal code of judicial ethics 150 years ago, but that definitely should have happened. Mike, thanks for the call. Blaine in Rochester.
Well, thank you for mentioning my ancestor, Samuel Chase. He was a scoundrel, but Scalia's got him beat by far.
So you know about Samuel Chase. Most people have no idea about
the old man. He appears in the Trumbull portrait, but I've got one that was done by Peel and his wife and these two lovely children. I don't know whatever happened to them except they produced my line.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
That was a thing. And I also worked for the Koch, so I know lots of scoundrels.
Oh, my. My goodness. Yeah, Samuel Chase is...
Thank you for your program because it's a vivisection of these people that are well-deserved. I don't know what's to be done about them, but you'll find a way, I'm sure.
Okay. Well, thank you very kindly, Blaine. And, good on you. Thank you.
I've heard my dreadful ancestor mentioned on the screen.
Okay.
And, of course, I'm just thrilled.
Great. Well, Blaine, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Jeff in Barstow, California. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you had mentioned Clarence, you know, hey, wake up and say something, Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you remember about 2.5 years ago, didn't he go into the IRS building on a Saturday and change over 20 years of tax returns?
I think it was over 10 years, but yeah. I don't know that he went into the IRS building, but he filed an amended statement about his family income, and yeah.
I don't think it was amended. No, he actually changed it.
Oh, he changed it.
He went back and changed it.
Yeah, it wasn't. It didn't have to do with the tax code, though. It had to do with disclosure of his spouse's income. Ginny, his wife, had made several hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Koch brothers,
my biggest disappointment about President Obama is that I elected a constitutional lawyer, and I thought the Constitution was going to come back, and never has.
Well, I think step by step. Yeah, President Obama has dropped the ball in some ways, but you want it really bad, vote for Romney. Or don't show up, don't vote, and you will have Romney. And then you think Scalia is bad? Romney would probably have Bork on the court. Oh. Shano goes, oh. You can tell somebody who's graduated from law school. All you have to do is say Bork on the court and get this shocked look. Okay, coming up tomorrow, speaking of all this, the Supreme Court is going to rule on Obamacare. Tomorrow morning we'll have the latest. Plus, my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science Rocks, BPA and brain cancer. What you need to know about what you're eating and what the Europeans already know. And the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. Occupy something. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.